It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast in association with Charles Tirrett. If you're in the UK, you'll know exactly how cold it's been over the past few days. It was -6 degrees when I left my house this morning. Our friends at Charles Tirrett are offering our listeners a special 20% off their collection. So if you fancy adding to your winter wardrobe, why not head online to charlestirrett.com and use the promotional code WISDEN22 and get 20% off their whole range. That includes shirts, polos, chinos, knitwear and outerwear. Anyway, on with the show. We've got loads to get through today. We'll be celebrating a decade of Joe Root as an England player, 20 years of Jimmy Anderson as an international cricketer. We'll be talking about Azeem Rafiq and Jahid Ahmed's appearance at the DCMS committee hearing early in the week. There'll be a bit on the final Pakistan-England test match, England in the West Indies, Australia's test summer, Bangladesh-India, your questions and more. I'm Yaz Rana and with me today is Katia Whitney, Phil Walker, and back for the first time in absolutely ages, Joe Harmon. Good to have you back, Joe. We've had quite a few questions just concerned about your well-being.
That's very nice as well. I saw them coming through. I'm absolutely fine.
Good.
Never been better. Raring to go. Have I missed much?
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah. Just a little bit. I'm sure you've been listening every week.
Of course. Love conquers all, yes.
So this week, as I said in the intro, marks 10 years of Joe Root as an England player, and more ridiculously, 20 years since Jimmy Anderson first played for England in an ODI at the MCG. We've probably spent about half of this podcast history struggling to find new ways of basically saying Joe Root's good, Jimmy Anderson's good. So we're going to try something a little bit different this week. We've all come up with our two favourite Root innings and two favourite Anderson spells each to mark the milestones. Joe, do you want to go first? And worth saying as well that the milestone is also celebrated in the new magazine that comes out this week.
Yeah, Phil spoke to Joe Root just before he headed out to Pakistan for the test series, reflecting on his decade as a test cricketer. This pod is going to make me feel very, very old. I think that's what I'm realising as you lined up there. It's a really great interview that Phil's got with him. He's
first time I've heard that.
You've been talking about it quite a lot.
From you, darling, from you. Oh. First time I've heard anything from you, one way or the other, on it. But, you know, we're all under pressure.
We were busy, weren't we?
We were busy.
Had deadlines to
meet. Hugely busy. Nice to hear anyway, thanks.
And he sounds nice and relaxed as you'd expect him to be after the few months that England have had. Tells some nice stories along the way, looking right back to his first Ashes tour when he's given an extra large suit in Chris Tremlett's size and he's struggling his way through the airport, kind of swimming in this massive suit.
Compares himself to Chandler out of Friends. With his sleeves rolled up.
And then quite a lot of kind of technical detail on his batting and some interesting stuff on his captaincy and the struggles that he had at the end there as well. So definitely worth checking out. That's out today, Thursday.
It's a long one.
It's a long one.
4,000 something words. Yeah, it's a long one.
Mm. But it didn't feel like a long one. So that's
it just gets better and better.
Anyway, do you want my innings?
Is that yes, I do.
Okay. So I've got two. I suppose they're both relatively recent in the second 5 years of the decade. The first I've gone for is Lords v South Africa in 2017, which was Root's first test match as captain. Got 190, strike rate of 80 in a game that no one else got a ton, and England won quite comfortably. Against a really strong South African attack, Morkel, Philander, Rabada. I guess there were always going to be question marks of how Root would adapt to the captaincy, whether he could continue to maintain his batting form. And that was the first example of the fact that he absolutely could. And I picked it, I mean, it's a brilliant innings in its own right, but I picked it particularly because it shows how brilliant Root was as a batsman whilst captain. And particularly in the later years when there was so much other stuff on his plate. It's an incredible sporting achievement, really, to have continued doing what he did with all the other pressures on. He averaged 46 as captain, 1400s across nearly 5 years. It's just a stunning record. Michael Vaughan always talked about having two hats as England captain, having your captaincy hat and your batter's hat and keeping them as separate as possible. And actually, Vaughan struggled with that. Vaughan's record as captain, as a batter, was significantly worse than when he was playing just as a specialist batter. Root did it brilliantly. Cook kind of has a similar record as captain, but didn't really have to deal with a lot of the challenges that Root did, certainly off the field stuff.
Just on that, and that particular element of his story, after that 190, I think he made 100 against India, didn't he, in Cook's valedictory game here at the Oval.
Yeah, got a little bit lost along the way.
But then after that, he did struggle a bit, right, as skipper at home, didn't he, in 2019 and 2020. I don't think he made an average sort of 30-something over three home
high
30s.
Then without, he's got a massive 100 in New Zealand. But other than that, was actually pretty quiet for a couple of years.
Well, that was the moments where he was getting lots of half centuries and couldn't get through to three figures, which is actually really interesting on in the interview with Phil as well. So yeah, there were blips along the way, but to be captain for that long and have that record, I think is to massively to his credit, as much for his determination and resilience as his skill as a batter. I mean, there's so many, and my second innings is much more about his technical skill as a batter. It's almost three innings in one, really, but I've gone for Chennai v India February last year. It's the kind of third part of his spin domination trilogy, where he got 228 at Gaul, 186 at Gaul in the next test, and then the 218 at Chennai to set up what's an incredibly rare defeat for India on home soil. And around that period when Root was just churning out these runs, there were just these greats of the game queuing up to say they weren't sure they'd seen anyone play any better against spin across their whole cricket watching lives, which, you know, there's no greater compliment than that.
The spin trilogy, I like that.
And it was just, I remember Ben Stokes saying during that series, it might have been after the Chennai game, he just makes us all feel pretty rubbish, because he was just playing, and this is from Ben Stokes, he's quite a good player, just saying, yeah, I mean, he's just operating on an entirely different plane. And again, going back to, if you think what everything else that was going on at that time, he couldn't get the team that he wanted because they were doing odd things with rotation. There's COVID, there's bubbles. And Root just comes out and plays like a god three test matches in a row.
And given how bad that year was for England, it is easy to forget they did start it with three quite impressive wins. And one of them was one of their best away wins ever.
Two doubles and a 180 odd.
Yeah, I mean,
from Root in that 3 week period.
Katia, how about you? What two innings from Root have you chosen?
I've gone with fairly modern as well, so 2016 onwards. First one that I've got is Johannesburg 2016. That 110, I think it was not out, he scored against South Africa. Because it kind of encapsulated him in kind of all lights. So he came in with us 22 for 2 as ever, and then I think soon we were 90 for 4, something like that. And he played this brilliant counter-attacking innings with Ben Stokes at the other end getting 50 against Morne Morkel, who absolutely peppered him. And it was such compelling cricket, but it also showed that he can be this counter-attacking, not so much swashbuckling, but counter-attacking batsman with Stokes at the other end. And it was just a brilliant, brilliant innings. And I think he said afterwards that it was, he regarded it as one of his best at the time. It's probably gone past now, but it was just cricket that was absolutely brilliant. And it was one of those moments that was just like, if you could reproduce that every single time, that would be amazing.
When I spoke to him, maybe just before that crazy winter that you talk of, he said that to me. He said the two innings that really stick in his mind was the Joburg innings, for how you describe it, you know, for sort of technical completeness, and the Trent Bridge 2015, like the masterpiece knock as well. They're the two that he puts right up there. That was admittedly a couple of years ago now.
He's got a few since.
Yeah. And Katia, your other one is one of his many, many hundreds in the last year or so.
Yeah, it's the one at Edgbaston this year, which was actually
which one was that?
It was the one where I was on work experience here.
That was the India game.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's pretty self-explanatory, to be honest. But for
Phil.
Well, For me, it was just because, especially once he passed 100, and I know he'd had those hundreds against New Zealand as well earlier in the summer, but he just looked like he'd had the weight of the world lifted from his shoulders. And once he'd reached 100, he just walked us through the entire repertoire of shots that he had, including that ridiculous reverse scoop ramp, whatever you want to call it, against, I think it was Shardell, actually. You know, the dab down to third man, the late cut, the reverse sweep. I think he finished the game with a reverse sweep, actually. And it was just, I think Atherton described it on commentary as just joyous batting. And it was absolutely like joyous to watch him and Bairstow at the other end just go about that innings in the way they did.
He tells Phil in the interview that he's never had more fun playing cricket than he's had this year.
But and he looks it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that innings and the ton at the start of the summer as well, when he was relieved of the captaincy, I think you can just see it, can't you? You can see it in his face. And we used to say that, even on the pod, I remember saying that when you watch him playing for the 50-over side, he just looks like he's having so much fun compared to the Test side, where it just looks quite hard work a lot of the time. And of course, it is incredibly hard work being England Test captain.
Mm. Phil, in fewer than 4,500 words, what are your favourite two?
You'll be lucky. I've gone for the 100 that he made at Trent Bridge in 2021, because it was his first home 100 in since that the back end of 2018, so it had those 2 years.
That's the one during your wedding,
and it's the one during my wedding. Yeah. And I'm nothing if not narcissistic, right? So I remember that one in particular, but I remember being updated as the day went on
I
about how
clearly,
he was going.
Yeah.
And
it was the talk of the wedding, I think. Wasn't it?
Talk of the wedding. I did a podcast, not sure, my rival podcast. I did that night, literally from the grounds of the wedding, and it was just a magical day for loads of reasons. And somewhere in the story is that Joe got 100. And although that game was drawn in the end, that was a significant moment for him in his captaincy story, I think. And he needed those runs.
England needed those runs.
And England needed those runs because they were behind on first innings. In the end, it rained in that game. And I think India were comfortable favourites to knock the runs off. But then they still needed, I think, 100 and something odd with 9 wickets in hand. And then it rained on the final day. So without that, England would have lost, almost certainly. And although I don't know the innings, the details of the innings that much, for obvious reasons, the significance of it for his story, I think it deserves its place in his story, even though it's not a big ton, it's not necessarily a particularly memorable ton, but it's important for him, I think, to have got that one. And the other one is an odd one, but one that matters to me a lot, and it was the final innings that he had in Australia in 2017-18, his first tour as captain, his second tour as a player. Famously, he's now played 14 test matches in Australia and never made 100. Until he gets that over the line, he'll never be satisfied. And there will always be a small little asterisk against his all-time greatness unless he can get over the line. But that particular last game at Sydney was a heartbreaker. The conditions, physical conditions, were inhumane. It was literally 48 point something degrees. The hottest day in Sydney since 1936, I think it was. And they were playing cricket. And if you remember, Mason Crane, poor sod, he was bowling leg spin into the non-existent rough. And the Marsh brothers, Perth Marsh brothers, who were used to that kind of horrifying heat, had a day out. Khawaja was dropped 5 times, made 170. This was the game when Root got 80-odd in the first innings. And if you remember, he was out with 10 minutes to go. And as he walked to the gate, Bairstow walked past him for 10 minutes left of the day. And Root just looked at him as if to say, what the hell are you doing? Why have we not got a tail-ender coming out here? Bairstow goes out there. Do you remember, Joe? 4 balls in, nicks off for naught. And it was just one psychodrama after another. Root had held himself together beautifully all tour. Gets to the second innings, and England are going to lose. Of course they're going to lose. But Root, by this point, is severely dehydrated due to the heat, due to a stomach upset. And he goes out to bat on the fourth evening in a trance. And it's astonishing to watch. And I was there, and we'd all suffered through it. And it was astonishing to watch. You know, he's normally that irritating cliche, busy. He was stock still, didn't move, stumbled out there like a ghost, didn't do any practice shots, didn't do any of his little runs. He was just stock still, and he batted technically beautifully. and repelled the lot. That night, went to hospital, woke up the following morning, England squad turned up, Root wasn't there, went out to bat. England went out to bat at 11 o'clock that morning, Root wasn't there. And then we heard that he was turning up in a car from the hospital, gets in, he's in within half an hour, doesn't know where he is, and bats again beautifully to lunch. Ends up, I think, 58 not out, gets to lunch. England, I think, are 8 or 9 down, last rights of the game, and he collapses in the dressing room and he's sound asleep at lunch when the last rights of the series are completed and England lose, of course, 4-0. And as the ceremonies taking place and the man of the match and the player of the series, blah, 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 Root is sound asleep. And it's just this achingly perfect metaphor for how grim that tour was for him, but also how dignified he was in the way that he dealt with it. And he maintained his quality. He made 450s in that series, despite being thrown heaps of shit from the start of the tour, from the Bairstow evidently headbutting someone to Stokes not being there. It was just a litany of disasters for him. And what he did on that tour won't ever get spoken about in grand terms, but I think quietly it was magnificent what he managed to pull off.
I think it's a good example of his toughness, which I think gets underestimated sometimes, in that you have cricketers like Graham Smith, Ricky Ponting, Alistair Cook. They're kind of characterised as tough cricketers, and no one's saying Joe Root's soft, but I think because of his demeanour, also how easy it makes batting look, sometimes just how tough and resilient he is can be underestimated. To have got through the challenges that he has done over the 10 years, I think he's, you know, one of England's toughest batters, as well as, you know, probably their best.
And also I'm glad that an innings where the rest of the team had a not only a difficult test match but a difficult tour was picked out, because if I think back over Root's 10 years, particularly in Test cricket, is just actually how much he's had to stand up by himself. I was looking at some numbers of the last 10 years, and Root averages pretty much exactly 50 in Test cricket. And if you take him out, the average top seven English batter averages 32, which is a more than 50% difference. So Root has been so much better than the rest. And then even globally, over the last decade, Smith averages just over 60, Williamson averages just under 60, Kohli just over 50. But actually, in England, people across the board have averaged a lot less. Australia and New Zealand are the two highest scoring countries in the world. So it's not fair to say Smith and Williamson have been that much better than Kohli and Root. It is much closer than that. The two I picked out, it's already been mentioned, but Trent Bridge 2015, I thought that was peak Root, making batting look so easy. Obviously, 60 all out in the morning, and then Root and Bairstow take the mick in the afternoon.
He's doubled the team score by a close. Yeah.
But the other one is kind of similar vibe to the Sydney one, but a little bit more positive. It was Bridgetown this year. I mean, if you had to rank Root's 28 test hundreds, this is probably quite near the bottom in terms of taking account the pitch, match situation, etc. But it was more that the winter that he had endured, captained that horrible Ashes series where England were, you know, lucky to get the nil, and you had 10,000 English fans. The ground was completely packed. When he got to his 100, the standing ovation was really quite similar to the one that Cook got at the Oval in his last test match. It was like the English fans were saying thank you. The English fans couldn't really go out to Australia, and this was their moment where they showed their gratitude to what Root had done. And for so much of his England career, so much of his captaincy, he was basically the only guy to average more than 35. Since his debut, the only other English batter to average more than 40 has got Knighthood. And then of the guys to average more than 35 in that time, two of those are Bell and Trott, who retired years ago. He's pretty much done it on his own until this year.
That idea of offering thanks to a selfless cricketer, Nasser Hussain alludes to that in the piece that Joe was talking about that I've done with Root. When Root made that 100 at Lord's, in the kind of the era catalyst 100, right, for the Stokes era, when he makes that unbeaten 115, I think it is, to beat New Zealand in a game that England were behind in, when he makes that 100, Nasser speaks quite a lot about that and being present at Lord's as the place rose as one, and there being that sense of a kind of outpouring of appreciation for a bloke who has been through the ringer here and there but has maintained some kind of integrity throughout, you know, and there was a real sort of celebratory feeling around his own personal achievement there. And there is a sort of catharsis to his story, I think, in the last year or so. It's a compelling one.
And I think the gratitude comes from a place of England were quite often really rubbish to watch, but however rubbish they were, there's one world-class
batter.
You always
want to watch
him. Exactly. Moving from one England great to another, I'm going to start with a quiz. Katie, I'm not going to expect too much from you here because you would have been quite young when the subject of this question took place. So to illustrate just how far he's come, I want you to try and work out slash guess the England 11 from Jimmy Anderson's debut game in 2002. So it's in that VB Tri series against Australia.
It was against Zimbabwe, wasn't it?
Australia.
Oh, sorry, yeah, the ODI game. Yeah. Oh, right.
So that is 20 years ago today, by the way. So the England ODI team against Australia in December 2002.
Can I get the notable, well-known ones straight away and
go
then
for
leave
it.
The rest of you to yeah, deal go with for the lesser it. Names? I'm going to say Alex Stewart.
Yep.
Nasser.
Yep.
Vaughney.
No. Vaughan's probably having a rest.
Side bottom.
No.
Collingwood?
No.
Well, who played in the 03 World Cup?
Good place to start. Oh, should get the openers.
Caddick?
No.
He played in the 03 World Cup.
Didn't he? Goffey?
Openers? No.
Triskovic?
Triskovic.
Mullally?
No.
No, he'd gone.
So I put you out of your misery.
But didn't he take something like... He went for about 12 runs.
So not his debut, but I think that's his second or third game. Right. I think he went 10 overs for 12 or 13 with six maidens. So he's
Mark Elam?
No.
Oh.
Great.
Hollyoak?
No.
Simon Jones?
No.
Harmison?
No. Right.
Thorpe?
No. I'm just going to go. So Triskovic and Knight.
Knight. Of course, Nick Knight.
Ronnie Irani at three.
Punchy.
Nasser Hussain at four. Owe Shaw at five, yeah. Alex Stewart at six, Ian Blackwell seven,
oh.
Eight Craig White, nine Gareth Batty, 10 Jimmy, and 11 James Curley. What an 11.
That would have taken us weeks. You'd have to edit that one.
Phil, do you want to kick us off for our favourite Anderson spells?
Yes, right. What have I got here? So I've got two. I was there for the first one, which was Kolkata. 2012 winter, and England won the game just as they'd won at Mumbai the week before. Nobody saw it coming. They went into the series in all kinds of off-field hassles with the Peterson saga, and
as the reintegration series.
The reintegration series, yeah. Peterson obviously did what he did at Mumbai, as everyone knows, the 180, and they won that game. And they went into Kolkata, and everyone was expecting a writing of this glitch. A correction in the story, and Cook went and got 190, and either side of it, Anderson was imperious with the ball. And as I say, I was lucky enough to be there at Eden Gardens to see it happen, and I think he took three in the first innings and three in the second. And it's the ones in the first innings that stick in my mind, because he got rid of Sachin Tendulkar, who was a good player, and Virat Kohli, who was also a good player, and he nicked them both off. He got three of the first six, top six out, and then came back in the second innings to finish it off. And although the series will be remembered for Cook's brilliance, three big hundreds, Peterson's scene stealers, and Swan and Panesar in Mumbai in particular, but Anderson on that first day, when you just assume it's going to be 500 plays, whatever, England might be able to summon or muster, Anderson was just untouchable. And that was the first glimpse that I saw of him away from home, beginning this astonishing decade that you spoke about literally 3 days ago on this show. The fact that he averages now less in India over the last 10 years than he does at home across the last decade.
Yeah, Asia in general, yeah.
Sorry, on the subcontinent, which is a mind blower.
Mm.
And that was 10 years ago now, and that pretty much to the week, and that's one for me. And another one briefly was, and I wasn't there for the final day of it, but I was there for much of it, was the Trent Bridge one-man show against Australia in the first test match when he took 10?
Mm. Yeah,
5-5?
Yeah, 5-5.
And he finished it off at the end, nicked off Haddin, and they had to go for the DRS and all of that. But it's
one of the great modern Ashes tests.
Mm. It is.
Which has sort of oddly got forgotten somehow.
Yeah. I think he bowled something like 13 overs either side of lunch. And it was one of those moments where it was him or bust. There was nobody else who was going to do the job for them. And Australia, as you say, they were getting very close to it. I think it was only... I should have it written down.
So it was a 12 runs in the
end? It was about a 12 or 13 run win in the end, yeah.
Steve Finn dropped a catch on the boundary, didn't he? When they needed 20 or so to win.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so there you go, those two. But I mean, my word, how do you narrow down Anderson's story?
I was going to say, I had a lot of fun just going through my favourite route in Anderson performances this week. Katia, what are your two?
I've gone for two from the same year. I've gone for Lords against the West Indies in 2017, the match where he took his 500th wicket, castled Craig Brathwaite, middle stump, I think it was, in the evening. But actually, the reason I remember that one particularly is the morning after. Not massively for anything that Anderson did, but because of, I think it was Michael Gough, who I have an image burned onto my memory of him covering his eyes and turning away after Anderson had just nipped one past the off stump, as if to say, how on earth is that not bowled you? And I think it just summed up everyone watching the majority of the spells he bowled, just going, how on earth has he not got out to at least one of those balls? And he ended up taking 5 for, and he had it on a string, as usual, that morning. And then the second one is Adelaide in 2017, where he took 5 for in Australia. And I like that one because there wasn't anything massively special about it. It was just that there had been a lot of talk about how Anderson Broad useless in Australia kind of thing. But it's like you said, Phil, that when there was no one else, it was just you have to give the ball to Anderson because he will make something happen. And it was the pink ball test match under lights, so the one that's going to suit him most. And he bowled 11 overs before the end of play in the third innings, and then he bowled 8 overs on the bounce straight up the following morning as well. And you had Wokes, and then you had, I think it was actually Overton.
It was Overton, I think, yeah.
And it was just that he was the only one who was going to take those wickets, and he did take them. So, you know, I think it just sums up the way that England have relied on Anderson so much. And I guess that as he's got older, we tend not to take him for granted as much, but I still think you always take someone for granted who's as good as he does and who delivers on such a regular basis as he does. I don't see a reason how you cannot take them for granted.
I very nearly chose a spell from the year before. Do you remember the Sri Lanka series at home? Where I think I've never seen a bowler just look so much, just like way, way too good for the opposition. I think there's one test where he finished with figures of like 10 for 40 or something like that. Joe, what are your two?
So I've gone with two spells that are actually 12 years apart, but quite similar thematically, in that they're examples of him kind of seizing control of a test match on the very first morning. I was there for both of them live, and they always tend to stick a bit more in the memory if you're there to witness them firsthand. So the first one was Adelaide 2010. I remember getting there on that first morning and there being a sort of collective groan in the press box when Australia won the toss and chose to bat. It was assumed to just be a road. There'd been stacks of runs at Brisbane. It was just expected to be more of the same. And then 13 balls into the innings, Australia 3 down. Obviously, the Jonathan Trott ran out, got the ball rolling. But then it was Anderson with a kind of classic away swinger to get Ponting. Swan takes the catch at slip. Then does the same thing to Michael Clarke in his next over. Swan takes the catch again. And then you got Shane Watson just after lunch and then another tail ender. So he only got 4 in the innings. Statistically, it wasn't up there with his best performances. But I really liked it as an example of how much he was developing at that stage, because he'd been taken to the cleaners on the previous Ashes tour. His away record was still poor, so he averaged 44 from 19 away tests going into that series. So a really poor record away from home. There was still that narrative that he could only really do it in England. And this was one of the first examples that actually he was developing the skills and the attitude to be able to do it in whatever conditions. And then, yeah, since the start of that Ashes tour in 2010-11, he's averaged 27 away from home. So for me, that was the kind of the shift in the narrative, really, from being a home, you know, kind of almost like a flat track bully or whatever the bowler equivalent of that is, at home, to suddenly being this incredibly skillful bowler wherever he was operating. And then the second one, a dozen years later, June this year at Lord's against New Zealand. Anderson's back in the side. Obviously, he's been dropped for the Tour of the Caribbean from the bits of county cricket we'd been watching. I remember on the podcast, I think Phil, but I think we all kind of collectively agreed, it looked like he'd lost a bit of zip. He wasn't taking stacks of county wickets like he usually does. And there was that sense that actually his career was on the line going into that test, which feels a very odd thing to say now because he's so embedded in it again. Gets Will Young caught and slips second over. Latham goes the same way in his third. And then suddenly it's just everything's as it should be. And it was bizarre to think we ever questioned it would be anything else.
That first spell was something like six overs, naught for two, wasn't it? Literally, something absurd like that.
And New Zealand didn't bat well, but Anderson gave them absolutely nothing. And then, but the bit almost I preferred was later in that innings, there was this kind of twist where England hadn't taken a wicket for about two overs and Stokes was getting bored. So suddenly they start bowling bounces and Anderson's running in bowling short balls. The two wickets he gets later in the innings are short balls. And he actually spoke to Felix, who had interviewed him just after that test and just before that test, about bowling the short ball for Lancashire and, you know, sort of taking the piss out of himself a bit as an old man trying to do this. And suddenly you see it in a test match and it's actually coming off. And he has taken quite a few wickets for the short ball over the last kind of 9 months. But also showed his willingness to embrace this new Stokes-McCullum era and to not take the safety first option, as he admitted he probably had done at times, to accept these much more attacking fields and to go hunting for wickets in a way that he might not have done for a while. And now he's a huge, huge part of this side. We've seen in Pakistan just how important he is. And how much England still depend on him, even when they're playing a completely different style of cricket to, well, let alone 20 years ago, but this time last year, and Anderson's still right at the heart of it.
But what's interesting about that, though, is that in Rawalpindi, his fourth innings was his shortest spell he's ever bowled, I think, statistically, which, as a 40-year-old on a tour, to try and find new ways of taking wickets on a pitch that just isn't friendly to the natural way you would bowl is just quite incredible.
What's this?
You look like Ringo Starr, right? Sort of 90s era Ringo Starr, massively so. It's uncanny. There you go.
Oh, wow. That's not good.
Peace and love.
My two spells are 18 years apart if it's a competition. So 2003 in the World Cup against Pakistan. If you've not seen it, watch it. That's Anderson bowling quick, swinging the ball away. I think he bowls Inzamam with an away swinging Yorker, which is pretty special. And then in Chennai last year, in the same test matches, the Root double ton that Joe mentioned, there's one over in particular that stands out when he clean bowls and gets the, I'm not sure if it was one over or maybe two, when he bowls Gill and Rahane and the stumps cartwheel, both reverse swinging. And yeah, a famous England victory to which Anderson was totally crucial and just demonstrating actually just how effective he can be on basically any pitch in the world.
What was your first one, sorry?
Cape Town 2003.
Right.
World Cup against Pakistan.
Yeah. It was Yusuf. Yeah. Yeah. Stunning.
I think he took four for 20
four,
odd.
Four for not much. Yeah. Yeah.
Both Anderson and Root will be in the England team for the final test of their series in Pakistan. There's not been a huge amount of team news. Nasim Shah has been ruled out of the test match for Pakistan. There's a possibility of a debut for Muhammad Wasim Jr., possibility that Shah Massoud comes into the side, as we talked about the other day. Joe, you've obviously not been on the pod during the series. What do you think England will do in the final test match? Do you think Rehan Ahmed will come in?
I think they'll be really tempted to give him a go. It would be a kind of fitting finale to this series where they've tried absolutely everything. That said, I think it's tricky to see how they get him in there, because it'd be the natural, swapping him in for Jacks would be the kind of the natural move. Comes in as the second spinner. He has got a first class ton at the end of last year for Leicestershire, but he'd probably be batting at number seven, probably at least one spot too high for him on test debut. The balance of the side gets a bit kind of messed up as a result. That said, they might just not care and just think, let's give it a go. I mean, I would love to see it. If I'm thinking what's the best way to win the test match, then I'm not sure it's playing him. If it's gone, let's just have a look. Why not? When are you going to get a better chance? 2-0 up in a series in Pakistan with a free hit, essentially. I wouldn't be surprised if they go that way.
Well, it comes down to what Stokes said at the start of the series, isn't it? We might chuck him a cap if we feel like it. I think that was his quote.
Did he really?
I think he said that, yeah. So, you know, joke. Put his money where his mouth is, actually do it. But yeah, I guess there's a couple of ways you could go, couldn't you? You could say, well, Anderson's bowled the most of any seamer on this tour. 40, Robinson's bowled a lot, Mark Wood's made of glass, give one of them a rest, throw in Overton, Ahmed, whatever, but I can't really see Stokes and McCollum doing that. I think they'll probably just go, what's the best 11 to win us a first 3-0 series whitewash in Pakistan and go with that. And that best 11 has, well, it's an unchanged 11 really, isn't it? So
Yeah, I think there's a case, though, that Rohan does improve the attack and improve the team. But Will Jack didn't really do anything in the last test
bowled
match. He bowled loads in the first test match. But then in this test match, Root bowled loads, and Root bowled really, really well. So if Root's your second spinner, I can understand if they want just something else from the guy who's the third spinner. And I agree, he probably shouldn't bat seven, but I'm not sure if England think like that. I think they'll just bat the top six to get the runs, and they'll think that Rohan can play. Rohan's batted, not only got the first class century, but there are a couple of, I think it's a 100 game where he batted at five as well. So he clearly rates his own batting.
He told Tahar he's a better batter than he is a bowler, which I'm not sure I believe that. I think that's a great thing to say when you're definitely a great leg spinner, or great leg spinner in the making, to say that I'm a better batter.
On players bigging up their batting, or bowlers bigging up their batting, Matt Potts told me at the start of the year that he viewed himself as an all-rounder.
With Ahmed, I think what it shows is there's so many people before the tour going, when he was selected, going, if you play him and then he does awfully and gets smashed, it will destroy him. And on previous tours, I think they might take that in mind, but I don't think they'll really do that now, because they'll back, first of all, Ahmed to have a strong mind enough to not let that happen, and then the team to be as positive and as backing as they are to not let that happen to him. So if they do chuck him a cap, and even if he does get carted out of the park, does it really matter as much as it would have done if it happened in previous tours?
And it's different to the Crane debut, for example. When Crane made his debut, he bowled loads in that test match. If Ahmed doesn't bowl well in this test match, he's not going to have to bowl that much. Yeah. Possibly be coming into the side for a guy who bowled eight overs in the last test match. And Stokes didn't bowl. We don't know how his knee is, but England do have options. They have so many bowling options that I think he's quite safe. Like, if it does go badly.
The dynamic is so... take Crane, or even go back to Borthwick as an example. Those were desperation picks at the end of a series where basically no one wanted to play anymore, certainly in the Borthwick tour. I mean, Swan had literally packed his bags and gone home. This is there is nothing to lose. So God, I'm talking myself into it. Yeah, play him. Absolutely play him.
Moving on, yesterday, Azeem Rafiq and former Essex seamer Jahid Ahmed appeared in front of a parliamentary committee hearing to give evidence on racism in the English game. The journalist George DeBell and Yorkshire chair Lord Patel were also there. It's been more than 2 years since Rafiq first went public about his experiences of racism, and more than a year since he first spoke to that same parliamentary committee. We had a few questions on this, and I think my main takeaway from it was just how much slower the action has been than we probably hoped a year or so ago. I watched the whole thing, and for me, the most striking part of it was when George shared the details of his correspondence he had with one county chair, where it allegedly emerged that that county had only sent one WhatsApp message to a player who had claimed that they had experienced racism at that club, and they hadn't received a reply and they hadn't done anything about it. And then later on, Ahmed claimed that he'd essentially received no support since he went public about his own experiences of racism a year ago. This is a quote from the hearing. He said, "From the ECB to the PCA to Essex even, I'm a victim and I don't feel like I get any support from anyone. Whether they care, I don't know, but it doesn't feel like I've had much support from it." Simon asks, what are your thoughts on the recent DCMS hearing, and how can the mainstream cricketing press do more to really address racism? My take on it is basically that we were talking about this before we started recording, if you go on news websites who've covered the hearing, a lot of the focus is on Rafiq, which is understandable given he was the first person to go public with it. But I think, as the hearing the other day showed, that the story is much, much bigger than that, and bigger than him. And I think, I'll hold my hands out. I don't think I've done enough in the last few months kind of looking at the other stories, but I think that is probably what the cricket media should do, focus on the other stories that are there that are still unresolved. There are still people who've said they've experienced racism, and it sounds like not that much has happened. Phil, it's obviously quite a difficult topic to navigate, but what were your overall thoughts from what happened?
It is really hard to sum up. And I'm loath to, because it will sound trite. It felt like it hasn't really moved the story along at all, and it hasn't really revealed much more than we knew in the first place. Well, there's a number of independent reports that are either currently taking place or have been delayed or have been released, and independent reports and investigations have taken place. And even within that, there is still a sort of morass of confusion around it. I played cricket with Jahid Ahmed. We were in the same club team. And it's undoubtedly been very, very difficult for him personally. Essex have released a holding statement pending their own independent review into his allegations and those of other people who have been involved. There is so much still to go here. And you still feel like in certain parts of the game, there is a reluctance to confront these awkward, horrifying truths. Indeed, if they are truths, and in many cases, almost all cases, they are, from what you hear from the people that you talk to. But I've also spoken to people who have been closely involved in county cricket, and who one or two I would count as friends, you know, who have been in these kinds of county dressing rooms, not incidentally the focal point dressing rooms, it's worth pointing out, but there remains a lot to do, there a lot of cultural resistance to acknowledging the idea of systemic problems. Rafiq's personal story is a very complex one now, and an increasingly complex one. And there are some people in cricket who are quite comfortable with his reputation being questioned and the integrity of his position being questioned because of other instances. Now, you can have Azeem acknowledging mistakes that he's made in his own story. That doesn't negate the abuse that he has received.
Part of the evidence that Rafiq gave the committee after they spoke was just actually just illustrated how many of his claims, I guess, have been corroborated by multiple people.
Right.
So it's an extremely long list. You can easily find it online on the DCMS website.
I think there's also an issue with the speed of these investigations as well. I mean, we're seeing that with Essex now. This is going on a long, long time. And not only do we want to get to the truth quickly, there are also people, you know, people, humans are involved here, hanging, waiting to see what will happen. We had the same thing with Yorkshire initially. Their policy was to take as long as possible in the hope that it would dissipate and no one would care anymore. And obviously that backfired in their faces massively. And obviously there are complicated legal issues here. I understand that. But, and I don't know the solution to this, whether the ECB can put more pressure on Essex to move things along as quickly as they possibly can, or whether they're already doing that. But it does no one any favours apart from the accused county that these things take long.
So I was talking to Taha, who was there, and he made the point that the lack of support Ahmed has received does make you wonder, why would a player bother? You go through a lot. You might not necessarily be someone who's comfortable being in the public eye. You have to go through a lot. A lot of people, a sizable minority, it is a minority, but it's a big one, don't believe you. It does make you wonder, why would a player come out? It's definitely not easy. And I think on the hearing itself, I thought it was quite a strange event in that the organisations that needed to be scrutinised weren't there. I mean, it was good to hear how, you know, exactly what the situation is now. But what I thought made the hearing last year so powerful was that you had the ECB there, you had Yorkshire there, and they were answering questions. And this time you had, to be honest, I thought quite ill-informed MPs. I thought some of their questions were quite poor, and it's quite clear they hadn't done a huge amount of research themselves. Got the impression they'd just flicked through the document they were given shortly before going on, and that was it. So it wasn't as constructive as I think it could and should have
there
been.
The first hearing from last year felt like there was a degree of rigour behind it, but I didn't get that impression.
Mm.
The bits that I've seen of this one and the quotes that I've read as well.
It was almost impossible to, because the wrong people were up there.
Right, yeah.
It's obviously good to hear from the people who were up there, but they were not the people who have the power to change the stuff that we need changing.
The bigger question, the overriding question is, how deep does this go? How embedded is this? And what's going to be done about it over the next period of time? It's going to be a long process. So much bigger than a set of individuals.
Mm. Linked to the story is that Gary Balance is leaving Yorkshire and returning to play in Zimbabwe next year. Balance had previously admitted to using racial slurs towards Rafiq. The pair met in the summer, and Balance, who last played for England in 2017, apologised to Rafiq. One of the saddest aspects of the Rafiq story is that he feels like he's been forced out of the country due to the reaction towards him speaking about his experiences. And quite a big part of the hearing the other day actually was Rafiq outlining that, specifically talked about some of the reaction to the Yorkshire Post covering of it. And Balance is obviously no victim, but on a human level, this is another young man leaving his home to make a new start somewhere else. Phil, you spoke to a journalist in Zimbabwe about the reaction in Zimbabwe to...
Yeah, to I spoke to Liam Brickhill, who's an excellent Zimbabwe-based journalist. And he's observed that the Zimbabwean cricketing public community have reacted cautiously, positively to this news. I mean...
It's a weird one if you're a Zimbabwe cricket fan, knowing what Balance has admitted to have said, etc., and this is the reason why it's coming. It's a complex one.
But possibly, as Liam alludes to, the feeling is that what happened in England with Yorkshire is an English-Yorkshire problem that doesn't necessarily find its way into Zimbabwean cricket, which has its own identity and its own story, and its own story of diversity as well. And you know, Liam suggests that perhaps Balance's story can be absorbed into what has become a very positive story about Zimbabwean cricket. So if you saw that squad that did so well at the T20 World Cup a couple of months ago, this was a very racially diverse squad. This was a squad that seemed to represent the best of a progressive cricketing culture. A kind of all, a complete range of races and ethnicities within that side. And so if Balance's story can be somehow absorbed into that and can be, and he can be, and he can find his way into embracing Zimbabwean culture again, then perhaps there is some kind of redemption arc in there, as Liam sort of alludes to. Look, it's very difficult, but look, I'm not in the business of enjoying watching somebody descend into despair. And Balance's spirit, as you rightly say, he's not a victim with a capital V, but he's suffered as well with the consequences of his own actions. And his mental health has gone through the floor. And if this is a possible way out, then I think you'd have to have a pretty vicious heart to stand in the way of that personally.
Yeah, I think I see this as a positive story, really, or a positive ending. I mean, Rafiq said when he met up with Balance in the summer that he now sees Balance as part of the solution rather than part of the problem. I think at some point, people will disagree with him, but I think at some point you have to put a line underneath it and let him have a new life. It was always going to be difficult to rehabilitate his character in county cricket, I think. You know, I wasn't surprised he left Yorkshire, but I was waiting to see which county he'd go to next. Then the news comes through that it's Zimbabwe, and I think there's a lot of positives to take from that. Dave Houghton, who's the Zimbabwe coach, who is Gary Balance's uncle. I don't think he's technically his uncle, but he's related to him through various connections. I thought his quote summed up quite well, actually. So he said, from the cricket side of things, I think it will benefit us greatly, but I think we also have to look at it from the other side. It's also going to be a big benefit for Gary himself. He's had a very difficult 18 months, 2 years. It's affected his mental health very badly. And I know from speaking to him recently that he's absolutely thrilled and excited to be coming back home and to be playing cricket with us. So from both points of view, I think it's a really good situation. Balance, he was born in Harare. He played under 19 cricket for Zimbabwe. This isn't necessarily him being kind of shunned and forced to a country. This is him going back to his roots. Would he have even come over to England in the first place if it wasn't for his cricket career? Possibly not. He got a scholarship to Harrow. So I hope that this will turn out to be a positive story. Houghton said he's keen to get Balance playing international cricket for Zimbabwe as soon as possible. He's going to play some domestic cricket first. And it will benefit Zimbabwe hugely. If they get the Gary Balance who was playing for England, what was it? I don't know.
Five,
6 years ago. I mean, they've got a bloody good cricketer there. So that is a good thing for kind of the landscape of those test nations kind of bubbling under who don't necessarily get the same opportunities.
Mm. Well, next up, a bit of a gear change. We'll talk about England's tour of West Indies. Katia, since we last spoke, Sophie Eccleston has had a couple of very, very good games.
She didn't play last night. There's a lot of rotation going on. But yeah, she's been, as ever, excellent. Charlie Dean last night on T20 debut, which
feels really
odd. I didn't realise it was T20 debut, but she actually said after the match, she took 3 wickets, and she said after the match it didn't feel like my T20 debut because played in the 100, played in ODIs for a while. Mm. But But yeah, she's also had a really, really good tour. She took, I think, 4-4 in one of the ODI matches. But in terms of the England side in general, they got pushed closer than they have been on this tour last night, which isn't saying much because I think their smallest margin of victory on the ODI tour was 142 runs. And then they won the first T20 by 8 wickets. It's difficult to try and form an opinion on this tour because it feels so developmental. And you've got to give England credit for winning the matches because you can only win the matches that are put in front of you. But when you contrast it with the Australia Tour of India that's going on at the minute, it feels like that is so much better preparation for the T20 World Cup that's happening at the minute, rather than trying to rotate through and find your best 11 on a tour of the West Indies on which you are dominating. So Nat Siver didn't play last night, Sophie Eccleston and Amy Jones didn't play last night, Lauren Winfield Hill kept wicket, Alice Davidson-Richards was in the T20 side, which she isn't normally, and it just feels a bit odd. And I always feel that when you're preparing for a major tournament like that, it's so much better to play and lose really close games of cricket than try and rotate through your players and find your best 11. If you can do both at the same time, like England did in Pakistan before the men's T20 World Cup, then brilliant. But mostly you can't. There are positives to come out. Like Lauren Bell's bowled really, really well. And considering at the end of the summer last year, she looked slightly, I'm not going to say lost because that's the wrong word, but she did look, like the rest of them, like they needed guidance and they needed pulling together and they needed that direction. And it's great to see that she's had that and she's really flourishing now. But it almost feels as if, and speaking before the tour, John Lewis said that, Heather Knight said actually that she thought John Lewis wasn't that far away from knowing what the best 11 was. At that point, he'd only been the coach of the side a week, so that's kind of saying something. But it almost feels like they've come away from this tour, or they will come away from this tour, bear in mind they're in still three T20s, with more questions than they've answered ahead of the T20 World Cup, especially given the injuries to Alice Capsey and Freya Kemp. Don't know whether they're going to be ruled out of the
Freya Kemp's World. Just news come through just now, she's got a stress fracture of the back, so she's definitely out of that and out for quite a long time potentially. She's already had a serious back injury which kept her out of the first 100 as well. I think it was a back injury, certainly a serious injury.
I guess from John Lewis' point of view, as we talked about when he was appointed, he hadn't met most if not all the players before, so from his point of view he's probably just getting to know, forming opinions of players he might not know that well.
But it just feels like this T20 World Cup is coming just about 6 months too soon. Given where they are, and they're good, like you can't, like on this tour you can't fault them for what they've done. I've said the smallest margin of victory was 142 runs in the ODI tour. They won the first T20 by 8 wickets, but it's just, there's something missing for me, and it's just 6 months too early.
It's not helpful that DeAndre Dottin retired from international cricket in the summer, saying she took issue with the environment of the changing room. Stephanie Taylor's missing this series with injury. You take those two out, the West Indies are significantly weaker side. But it is hard to prepare for these tournaments because England are essentially preparing to hope to beat Australia in a final. Like that's really where they are at the moment. India might have something to say about that, but those three are so far ahead of everyone else at the moment. I think England haven't lost a T20I series to anyone other than Australia for 9 years. So they just don't really lose them.
They don't lose them, but there is still stuff like if you're comparing it to the India-Australia series that's going on at the minute, what's really stood out for me is that in those moments, both those sides have players, especially with the bat, that go on once they've got 40 or 50 and make those bigs, 80s, 90s, whatever. And that's something that isn't happening as much for England. Like on this tour, you said the West Indies are weak and they don't have, DeAndre Dottin's retired, they don't have Stefani Taylor. Hayley Matthews is a really, they're really dependent on Hayley Matthews. But apart from Nat Siver's 90-odd in the first ODI, you've had Danny Wyatt making 60. I think Amy Jones has made a 50. But none of them, Dunkley got 47-odd last night. But none of them have gone on after that to go and really put them to the sword and put the game to bed. And whilst if you get bowled out in an ODI for 240 against the West Indies or you post 140 in a T20, you'll be able to run through the West Indies. You won't be able to run through Australia or India, so it won't fly when you're playing against those two. And when India came in the summer and played that T20, yes, they won the series, but they lost one of the matches and they easily could have lost the last one. And again, no one went on and made those really big scores for them in that series.
Your moment of the week is from that Australia-India series.
Mm, yeah, it is. The super over. Brilliant, brilliant game. And so it started with Mooney and McGrath absolutely hammering the India bowlers. But they posted their highest ever total against India. And at that point, I just thought, there's no way. There's absolutely no way they're getting them. And the remarkable thing is, they should have done it easily. They should have done it with an over to spare. Smriti Mandanna scored 79 and then got out with three and a half overs to go, and they needed 40. And it felt like, I think someone said on when I was chatting about it, that typical India, you know, they're going to get so close and then they're not going to do it, and you never get an opportunity to beat Australia in any match. They haven't been beaten since March 2021 before this in T20s. And then Ghosh came in and hit three sixes in six balls, and then played a just mind-blowing penultimate over where they still needed like 22, and then they blocked out for singles the penultimate over. And then she took a single off the first ball of the last over, so she wasn't on strike. And then I can't remember who it was off the top of my head.
Vaidya.
Yeah. Needed five to win off the last ball, so a six or a four to take it to a super over, and she hit the four and took it to...
I'm on the edge of my seat. What happened in the super over?
No. So much. But they posted 21 in the super over, which is massive. 21. And then Australia came in, and they didn't send out Mooney or McGrath. First up, they sent out Healy, which I understand.
Gardner,
who hadn't batted in that match before.
That seemed very odd.
Very odd.
First ball as
she was. So yeah, they stuffed it up essentially. But when you're... All of this, by the way, was me clicking refresh on Quick Info because you can't actually watch it in the UK.
I enjoyed that. I had no idea, shockingly. That was excellent.
Joe, your moment of the week is not from a game, but a piece of news that is quite big.
Yeah, news came through overnight, UK time, that Kane Williamson's stepping down as New Zealand Test captain. Done it for 6 years. Best win percentage of any New Zealand skipper ever.
I thought he'd do it forever.
Captain this team to the inaugural World Test Championship title. Yeah, well, he's had a few injuries. Hasn't actually played a huge amount of Test cricket over the last couple of years. So I didn't see it as a huge shock. You know, it's a long time to have done it, albeit you don't have the fixture schedule that England do through no fault of their own. But I think it's fair to say he's done his bit as captain. I think the surprise is who's replaced him. They've gone for Tim Southey over Tom Latham. Tom Latham's been the vice for a while now. He's captained, I think, 9 tests in Williamson's absence. Southey's done a bit of white ball captaincy, but never captained the test side. Southey's 34, Latham's 30. And Southey, after two brilliant years in test cricket, has had a relatively poor 2022. I think he's averaging 40 with the ball. Was made to look very ordinary by England this summer, although that's true of quite a lot of bowlers over the last 9 months or so. And it just feels like a bit of a backward step. And I think maybe it's symptomatic of where this New Zealand test side is and potentially going. We've talked a little bit in the past, that there doesn't seem to be that new generation really hammering the door down to kind of force some of the old guys out or take over the spots from people who have retired. When you think about New Zealand beating India in a World Test Championship final, when you think about the difference in financial resources, the player pool, it's kind of almost miraculous, really, they managed to pull that off. And I do think over the next couple of years, we're going to see a sort of levelling off where New Zealand probably slip down to, you know, more of the kind of Sri Lanka, hopefully not West Indies, but that kind of level, because I just don't see the players coming through to keep this train going, really. Especially when you throw in the fact that they're having issues getting tying down players on long-term contracts who are looking to go and play franchise cricket, like Trent Bolt. I hope none of this comes true. I love the New Zealand team. I think they've done amazing things, but that feels like the direction of travel for me. The flip side is that Gary Stead, the New Zealand coach, has said Williamson standing down as Test captain will hopefully prolong his career as a Test cricketer, as a specialist batter. So we'll have to wait and see on that. But it's a slightly tricky time for New Zealand at the moment. I don't think a 34-year-old seamer taking over as your test captain is necessarily going to invigorate things very much.
Well, I wanted Broad to be the England test captain, so I guess I have to back this.
Different time, though, wasn't it? Hang on, who wanted Sam Billings?
Well, I don't think we should go back into that.
No one in this
room. But none of the Fab Four are captains anymore. You wouldn't have guessed that a year or so ago. Elsewhere, Australia beat West Indies 2-0. Labuschagne's got another 100. Scott Boland in his first test since the Ashes took a triple wicket maiden in his first over of the second innings. He now averages less than 5 in the second innings of test matches.
Something about Scott Boland just makes me feel awful. Whenever I hear his name, it's just traumatic. Terrible memories. It's traumatic. Yeah, it's like post-traumatic stress disorder.
Phil, Australia plays South Africa now. We've got a couple of questions in. Do South Africa have a chance? Joe asks... I fear their batting lineup is too brittle for it to be a contest. I kind of agree.
I agree wholeheartedly. I went through their squad a couple of days ago, waiting to see a name that could convince me otherwise.
Yeah.
Bavuma's back in the side. I hope he has an okay series. You know, he's a cricketer I like a lot, but I just cannot see the runs there, and it's a flimsy middle order with a keeper that I'm not really convinced by. Keeper back that I'm not convinced
by. Yes. And then Ben's not here.
Right.
But we've got questions on what does this mean for the World Test Championship? Phil, outside your comfort zone.
Massively
a little
out
bit.
Of his comfort zone.
This is good stuff, right?
Should have heard the conversation with Ben before this podcast. But.
Right. Come round, folks. Okay, so there are 5 teams, by my reckoning, or rather by Ben's reckoning and my dodgy notes, that can still qualify for the WTC final next summer. Australia are top, South Africa are third, South Africa are second, India are fourth, Sri Lanka are third, and Pakistan are fifth as it stands, but obviously that doesn't mean anything in the scheme of it. I'm going to try my best here. Australia, if they whitewash South Africa in those 3 test matches, then they can afford to lose all 4 tests against India in the spring and still make it. So 3-0 to Australia against South Africa, and it's in the bag for Australia. However, if they lose 1 game against South Africa and get whitewashed by India, then they're very, very likely to be dumped out. So this 3-3 match series against South Africa is very important for the shakedown of this. If South Africa win 2 test matches in Australia, long shot, but if they do, that puts themselves in a very strong position, in inverted commas. But they'd still need to beat the West Indies 2-0 to confirm it. Okay, so 2 wins in Australia for South Africa, 2-0 win against West Indies in the spring, and they'll be in. If they get whitewashed in Australia, they get beat 3-0 in Australia, then it's curtains for South Africa. So that's what's on that series. India are currently in the midst of a test match against Bangladesh that they're almost certainly going to win. That would be part one of their 6-part march to the final. If they win 5 of the 6, I'm doing really well here.
Brilliant.
If they win 5 of the 6, including the current game against Bangladesh, then they are almost certainly there. If they win 6 out of 6, they're definitely there. Remember, 4 of these 6 games are against Australia in a showdown in the spring. Sri Lanka, what a story that would be. They are still in the mix.
Chris Silverwood's Sri Lanka.
Frank Lampard's Sri Lanka, yeah. Chris Silverwood's Sri Lanka. They're outside bets, but they can still just about pull it off. If they beat New Zealand 2-0 in New Zealand, big, big ask. But then they did go to South Africa a couple of years ago, didn't they? The Pereira series. And if they get a 2-0 win in South Africa and Australia lose a game against South Africa and India don't win all of their games, then Sri Lanka are in the final.
Wow.
So they've just got to go to New Zealand, nick a 2-0, and hope that other results go their way. And it's not inconceivable that India don't win them all.
What's the Kevin Keegan line? They've got to go to Borough and
get
something.
They've still got to go to Middlesbrough and get something, right?
Excellent. So look, there you go.
That was surprisingly clear.
That was
kind of good. Peter Snow swingometer vibes there. I think we should get...
I feel exhausted.
It's like watching The Big Short.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Next question. Do you think
He hasn't got anything else. Don't push for a second.
I'm done.
Do you think a single Test cricketer knows any of that?
No.
And
I wonder how many care.
Do you reckon someone has
think about it?
Yeah. I was wondering, do you reckon there's been an England player this week gone like, what do we need for the World Test Championship? Not knowing that they're
Ollie Pope. I reckon Ollie Pope said that.
Well, the thing is, I know it goes completely against the logic of having a World Test Championship in the first place, but I asked someone, who would you want to see in the World Test Championship final? Mm. And none of the names that were mentioned came up in that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. So. Well, as Phil mentioned, Bangladesh are playing India at the moment, and India are going to win that one. Interesting thing from the final ODI there, Ishan Kishan scored the fastest ever ODI double 100 putting a bit more pressure on Shikhar Dhawan's spot in the side for the World Cup next year. Phil, what is your moment of the week?
Oh, just very, very briefly. I went up to Lancashire, went up to Old Trafford on Monday night to do a panel chat discussion thing with Paul Allott and Scott Reid, the BBC Lanx commentator, and Lizzie Ammon, the Times reporter, for their members' Christmas do. So, you know, it was crackers and stuffing and all the rest of it. And there was 600 people in the point. Quite a big gig. And yeah, we had a nice chat, you know. But it was lovely because it reminds you of the groundswell of
people care.
People who really do care very deeply about this thing that we sometimes wax on a Tuesday morning and wonder if we're speaking into the void. Well, we're not, because it retains great value and importance to people's lives. And it was nice to kind of be reminded of that on a Monday night. Coming back on the Tuesday was tricky. Booked my train, ended up getting on a coach. Took me 7 hours. Up the workers, don't get me wrong. Up the workers. But that was a tough one to get home from. Mm.
Joe, there's a new magazine out today. Other than the Root interview, what was in it?
Loads of good stuff. I was going to start with, because I know I don't want to say our listeners are geeks, that would be a bad thing, but you know, there are the cricketing intelligentsia.
Nice. Quite right. Well done.
Who listen to us. So we've done a quiz of the year in this magazine, which is bloody hard, possibly too hard. But I think a lot of our listeners might enjoy it. You can also win Joe Root's bat.
Wow.
And second prize is a load of kit from ProDirect.
Yep.
So some good prizes there. It's a fun quiz. And also, it's not one of those ones that I don't think anyone's going to get 100% here. I'd be amazed if they do. So even if you don't know a few, doesn't mean you're out of the running. Stick with it.
Mm. I reckon 40% results and you're in. You're
I think
in the mix.
I think you gave me this quiz a couple of weeks ago and it is so difficult. It is so difficult.
It's worth it alone for Jim Honest's, who said it, Elon Musk or Kevin Peterson,
yes.
Which is probably the best thing he's done for us in the 2 years he's been with us so far. That's not a reflection of what he's done previously. It's just how good this quiz is. Surprisingly hard.
Just on that, did you see what Kevin Peterson tweeted, I think either this morning or yesterday? But that could have gone straight into the, is it Peterson
it's
and Musk?
It's marvellous.
It was Qatar, Saudi and Dubai in a few days. The Middle East is thriving, economically stable and growing fast, safe and secure. Education, great and sunshine, where everyone is smiling. I can see why so many people have moved and are considering leaving Europe to live here. Hashtag the place to be. Peterson or Musk?
Hashtag sponsored ad as well. I mean, what?
Quite possibly.
Allegedly.
So that, definitely go and check that out. It feels like a long time ago now, but we've got 22 reasons why England won the T20 World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And
we had to do it, Joe.
We did. And it's good. It's good. It feels like this, you know, cricket moves on quick. And connected to that, Mel Farrell has done a really good interview with Matthew Mott, England's white ball coach, which in amongst it, he says he thinks ODI should be cut down to 40 overs, men's and women's, after the next World Cup. And there's some interesting stuff in there about the kind of dynamic of the England dressing room as he sees it, as an Aussie coming in and witnessing it firsthand. I spoke to Munir Ali, Moen's dad, about his kind of remarkable story, how he got to where he has done. His dad has played a pretty big role in that, I think it's fair to say, according to his dad, also according to Moen, in fairness, but
it's an amazing story.
Yeah, talking about kind of sacrificing stuff for your kids. It's another level, really.
The line that comes out, Munir says to Moen, "Give me 2 years of your life, and you can have the rest. And if after those 2 years we haven't cracked it, then fine, we shake hands. But give me 2 years, you know, no going out, no mates, no girlfriends, no nothing, just 2 years." And they practice what morning, noon and night, and obviously the rest is history. But it's an amazing story.
Yeah, so he was a psychiatric nurse at the local hospital, but couldn't find time to do that and the night shifts and take all his kids to their cricket, so he quit being a nurse to focus almost exclusively on ferrying his kids, because obviously Kadir, Moen's older brother, also played county cricket, and there's a younger brother who played a bit for Warwickshire Academy. And to raise funds to do that, he sold chickens door to door in the local neighbourhood, quitting his profession. So he's a fascinating bloke to speak to. Other stuff in there, we've got Taha. We still let him write for us even though he left. He's done a piece on Rian Ahmed and what his kind of stratospheric rise says about the state of English spin bowling. Got Liam Plunkett's cricket life, spoke to me about the highs and lows of his career. Bruce Talbot has done a really good piece on Sussex and what's going on there. It's a bit of a mess of a county in lots of ways. He knows that county inside out, so he's kind of spoken to the chairman. You know, it's a kind of hopeful piece, but also acknowledging that it's just been a mess of a couple of years. Lots of players leaving. Katia has done a piece for us on John Lewis's appointment as England women coach. And all the columnists are great. As usual, we've got Adam Collins is back for the Aussie summer. We asked him, is Australia falling out of love with its men's cricket team? And he's responded. He's basically written a response to that, looking at the kind of culture war that is afflicting Australian cricket, largely as a result of Justin Langer's departure and the way that's viewed, and the fact that
Pat Cummins appears to be too woke.
Yeah, Pat Cummins is too woke to be Australian cricket captain. Or is he? I mean, it's more nuanced than that, but that's what Colo's looking at. Phil, anything else that I haven't asked? Quite a lot of it, isn't it, really?
Yeah, there's quite a lot. That'll probably do. Matt Parkinson is excellent on how to bowl with a white ball, basically, and the psychology of it as well.
This is the coaching section. This is the coaching section. People can get in touch with.
Indeed. Echo that point again and again. Whatever your problems, whatever your queries, whatever kinks in your action that you can't quite figure out, please do write in. We'll take them to our band of coaches and see where it gets you. But there's a real good range in this one. The Hour That Changed Graham Napier's Life is a beautiful interview on the final page done by Jimmy Wallace as well. So yeah, it's good. It's nice.
Nice one. Well, as ever, you can get the magazine at wisdom.com/shop. That is the end of the show. Slightly longer than the one we did last Thursday. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Katia. This has been the Wisdom Cricket Weekly podcast. We'll be back after the third and final Pakistan England test.
Podcast Network.